It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a lot of Wisconsinites lack adequate health insurance, and state officials are looking to get more people covered. We'll talk to an expert about what hurdles are in the way for all residents to get comprehensive health insurance. First, pizza remains one of the most popular foods in the country, according to a recent poll, admittedly conducted by a pizza chain. Some 22% of Americans said if they could only eat one food for the rest of their lives, it would be pizza. From New York style to Chicago deep dish, pizza comes in a lot of shapes and sizes. One unsung hero of the pizza world is maybe one of the easiest to make at home, pan pizza. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we talk about the ins and outs of pan pizza with one of the foremost experts in the country. Peter Reinhardt is a baker and author. His latest book is Perfect Pan Pizza, square pies to make at home from Roman, Sicilian, and Detroit to grandma pies and focaccia. Peter, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob. Great to be with you.
Why did you want to tackle pan pizza specifically?
Well, you know, we've been eating pan pizza for a long time. It hasn't been the sexy, topic because we sort of take it for granted. It seems like it's old school. But the fact is that people love pizza in any form. And just in the last couple of years, this style, this category of pizza has gotten some serious traction, mainly driven by a couple of categories, the main one being, believe it or not, Detroit-style pizza, and which has been around for 65, 70 years, and all of a sudden just kind of broke out of the box and is going national, and there's a reason for it. It tastes really, really good.
Well, I grew up in southeastern Michigan, and in hindsight, I often ate Detroit-style pizza. I didn't even know it was called Detroit-style pizza. What is it that makes it a distinctive style of pizza?
Yeah, I don't think people who live in Detroit call it that. They just call it pizza. But because the style kind of is associated with a particular kind of pan, a rectangular pan made out of blue steel that came from the auto industry. This style was sort of originated or gets credit for being originated by a guy who used to work there in the 1940s. When he retired, he took a whole stack of these blue steel pans with him and opened a bar and grill and started making pizza in these pans. And the steel pans conducted heat so well that they created a wonderful crust. I call it the undercrust. The bottom part of that crust gets so crispy and flaky, and it's almost like the best hot buttered toast that you ever had, that it became the distinguishing characteristic of this pizza, along with a choice of cheese. He uses Wisconsin brick cheese as sort of the original cheese choice. It's hard to find around the country, so a lot of other places are using combinations of cheese to approximate that flavor. But Wisconsin brick is sort of the definitive cheese. So anyway, it just picked up its own identity. And then a few chefs found out about it and took it to places like New York and L.A. and Chicago. And all of a sudden, it became the hot new kid, even though it's been around since 1945.
For people wanting to make pizza at home, I think your biggest tip to success is that the way to get good at making pizza is to make pizza and learn and keep developing along the way. And you eventually start to get a feel for it, it sounds like.
Yeah, and it's really like, you know, low risk, because there's only two kinds of pizza, Rob. There's good and there's very good. I mean, you can't really screw it up unless you maybe burn it. But most people won't do that. But there's a couple easy tricks that make a difference between good and great. And one of those tricks is make the dough at least one day ahead. You can even hold the dough for 3, 4, 5 days in the refrigerator, but it's always best to make it at least one day ahead and let it rise very, very slowly in the refrigerator. It changes everything about the dough. The chemistry of that dough goes through a lot of transformations brought about through enzyme development and yeast and bacterial fermentation, and it just makes a difference. And that alone can take an average pizza and turn it into a great pizza.
Now, you solve a problem that is, it's one of the things that keeps me from making my own pizza, actually. It's spreading the dough on the pan. I always find it a pain. I rip it. There's holes. You have kind of a step-by-step premeditated process. How should we be doing this?
Yeah, what I advise is for all the different styles of pizzas in this book, which all can be made from the three basic doughs that are given in the book, and any style can be made from these doughs, is to allow at least 1 hour from the time that you put the measured amount of dough in the oiled pan to spread by pressing it out with your fingertips and giving a 20-minute rest. And every 20-minute resting period allows the dough to spread a little bit more the next time. And by the end of the hour of this, what I call dimpling the dough, it will eventually cover and fill the whole pan. During the resting, the gluten, which is very elastic, will start to relax, and it allows you to spread the dough a little bit more and a little bit more. And again, one of the differences in this style of pizza from the sort of what we call the Neapolitan pizzas or the round pizzas that we're so familiar with is that the dough is given time to rise. It's not just spread and then put in the oven. And so from the time that the dough fills the pan, if you allow 4 hours at room temperature for this dough to rise very slowly and gradually, it will produce an incredibly delicious, airy dough that won't taste bready when you eat it. It will taste creamy. And again, a characteristic of these doughs, the only difference between, let's say, a grandma pizza, which is one type of pan pizza, and a Detroit-style pizza or a focaccia, is the amount of dough that you put into the pan.
Talking to Peter Reinhardt, his new book is Perfect Pan Pizza. Let's go to our callers. I haven't given the number yet. If you need it, it's 800-642-1234. Mike is with us in Sheboygan. Mike, hi.
Hi. Well, I'm excited because I read your book last week, and I'm all motivated, but I'm a little bit confused about the dimpling process, I understand, and putting it in the refrigerator overnight is what confuses me. When you bring it out the next morning, do you have to let it rise 4 more hours before you can bake it? I mean, there seems to be sort of an overlap there that I'm not quite understanding.
Well, there's a couple of different ways you can approach it. Like you can put the dough in the pan right after you mix it and the night before, and just measure out the amount for the size pan you have. And on page 15, there's a chart for how much dough based on the size of your pan. And you can either start the dimpling process then and get it to fill the whole pan, or you can just put it away overnight, which is what I do. I put it in the pan, cover it, and then I start the dimpling the next day. And I'll pull it out of the fridge at least 5 hours before I want to make my pizza. And the first hour is for the dimpling and the spreading of the dough. And then the final 4 hours are for the rising time. And you can either start the clock after the dimpling on the second day, or you can do all the dimpling on the first day and then start the clock when you pull it out of the fridge. But it still takes about 4 hours for the dough to wake up, for the yeast to sort of come back to life and to start fermenting the dough, and for you to get those beautiful airy pockets.
Mike, hope that helps. Let's go now to Joe with us in Jefferson. Joe, hello.
Hi, Peter. I'm curious, maybe there's something I'm misunderstanding, but I grew up on the East Coast in New Jersey, and you know, every pizza place you go into, if you don't see it right away, because it's outsold by the triangle slice, you know, like 5-to-1, there's a square pan pizza known as Sicilian. And when I heard you say that Detroit pizza started there and then went to New York, it must have went to New York as Detroit pizza, but didn't this Sicilian pizza, you know, wasn't that around before that? And then I have a question about how making it, because I make it myself. So,
sure. First, yes, you're right. So I think Sicilian pizza probably went to Detroit and then became Detroit pizza over there. A Sicilian is a name given to a type of pizza baked in square pans that basically was made, I would say, probably first in Brooklyn and attributed to Sicilian to differentiate it from Neapolitan, which is Naples. But really, I'm not sure that what we call Sicilian pizza actually exists in Sicily as Sicilian pizza. They have their own styles of pizza there. One is called sfingiuni. They're all variations on a theme. But you're right. Sicilian pizza is maybe, you could say, the grandmother of the grandmother of the grandma pizza and sort of the beginning of all the variations in America that are baked in square or rectangular pans.
And Joe, you had a how-to question?
Yeah, well, and that reminds me, too, I think I read somewhere that the guy in Detroit really got it from his grandmother's, Sicilian grandmother's recipe.
So there you go. Maybe that's,
yeah. But
look, most of us know in the food world, we know that we don't invent anything new. We basically borrow and get inspired by ideas of others and then see if we can push it to another level.
Yeah. And also on the Food Network, I was watching Alton Brown, who gives a lot of background, make a point that a lot of Italian-American food that we think of, like chicken parm and all that, actually came out after immigrants came to New York City, and it was developed there because it was not found in Italy.
All right, Joe, what's your how-to question before we have to take a quick break here?
I was surprised that what makes that dough really work is the hydration rate. As you know, with baking, hydration, which is how much water you put in, it's 70%. And the dough is always sticky. It's not the kind you see a guy throwing up in the air with his hands. You dump it into the pan, and 48 hours of fermentation. That's what I did, and it came out great.
Joe. Thanks.
Also, but just to correct that, it's 80 in my version, 80% hydration, ooh, which is more than you would get in most pizzerias. And that's one of the tricks that I think makes this. I think that the versions in this book actually, you know, kind of push the envelope even beyond what you would see in pizzerias, because most pizzerias they have to make the dough easier for their staff to handle. And a stickier dough, like 80%, is tricky. But the instructions in the book guide you through it, and it's actually not so hard once you figure it out.
Thanks, Joe, for the call. We're talking to Peter Reinhart, baker and author. His new book is Perfect: Pan Pizza, Square Pies to Make at Home, from Roman, Sicilian, and Detroit to Grandma Pies and Focaccia. He's with us today to talk about pan pizza on Food Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a how-to question for Peter? Do you have a favorite pan pizza recipe? Are you looking for advice? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can find some recipes, by the way, at WPR.org/Food Friday that Peter has shared with us. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation about pan pizza with Peter Reinhart. His new book is Perfect: Pan Pizza, Square Pies to Make at Home, from Roman, Sicilian, and Detroit to Grandma Pies and Focaccia. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a favorite kind of pan pizza to make or a question about how to make it. That's 800-642-1234. Peter, before we go to another caller, let's talk about what kind of pan. We can't all smuggle Detroit steel out of the auto factory to make our pans. What do you recommend we buy instead?
Yeah, that's the great news, is that these wonderful blue steel pans are not, even though they're part of the lore of the pizza, they're not essential to making a great pizza. You can use any kind of baking pan, a cake pan. It doesn't even have to be square. It can be a round cake pan. It can be a brownie pan. It's just for certain pans, for the pizzas that are like Sicilian and grandma pies, they can be baked in a regular, like a 11 by 17 inch, what we call sheet pan or half sheet pan for home cooks, that are fairly standard. But for the Detroit style pizzas, which are the ones that I think, you know, are the most interesting in the book, they're all very interesting. But I think the star of the book and the first half of the book is dedicated to the Detroit style, is that your pan should have at least a 2-inch wall around the edges so that the dough can not only rise up around it, but that the cheese, of which there's an abundant amount, as it melts while you're baking it, will kind of melt down the side of the dough and not go into your oven, but the pan itself will hold it, and it will cause a very nice crispy cheese edge around the outside of the pizza that we call a frico. And the frico is not the most important part of this pizza, but it's sort of like the bonus piece. It's like that little crispy edge, like you might get a cheese cracker. And a lot of what I think makes this pizza exciting is the textures as well as the flavors. You get the crispy cheese edge, you get the crunchy toffee-like undercrust of the pizza where the dough is essentially being fried in the olive oil that you've greased your pan with. And then you get a very creamy center part of the dough as the dough rises. And one extra trick that we've added to this pizza that is, I think, a game-changing trick, and it's not something you're going to see in any pizzeria except one place in Texas where we basically invented this technique, and I think it could show up everywhere else later. But once you try it, I think you'll agree it's amazing, is to put half your cheese on the dough before the four-hour rise, and then the other half right before you bake the pizza. And so what happens is as the dough rises, it embeds the cheese in the dough, so that when you bite into this slice of pizza, and I kid you not, it's kind of like eating the best grilled cheese sandwich with a pizza on top, and it will ruin you forever for pizza.
Let's go back to our callers now. Amanda is with us in Green Bay. Amanda, hi.
Hello. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Peter, it's such a thrill for me to talk to you. The Bread Baker's Apprentice changed my life. I just have to say that.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. My question has more to do with, I make a lot of focaccia, but I also make my own sauces, and my red sauces, I've found that when I make like a homemade marinara or something, and I do a deep dish pizza like this, how do you keep that red sauce from making this nice, light, crisp pizza soggy?
I've been there too, Amanda, where it tastes good, but yeah, you get a little sogginess from your sauce.
Yes. And there are a couple tricks. Here's a few. One is, one of my favorite new tricks is I put the sauce on after the pizza comes out of the oven, and I put it on either at room temperature or you can warm it up. But I like to put it on just cold from the fridge and let it warm up on the hot pizza. And so you get this great contrast of a kind of a fresh tomato sauce that's warming up on the hot pizza. That's one option. Another, and this is the grandma pizza trick, which was developed by Umberto's Pizzeria in Queens, New York. At least they get credit for it. Not everybody else, claims to make their own grandma pizza. And that is, they slice the cheese instead of grating it, and they lay slices of the cheese over the surface of the dough before they bake it, and then they put the sauce over the cheese so that the cheese becomes a barrier between the sauce and the dough, and it protects the dough from sucking up all that sauce while it bakes. And then the third option would be to do what the Sicilian technique is, which is to partially bake the dough. We call it par-bake the dough. Get it kind of golden brown, but not quite finished. And then put your sauce and cheese on after it's been baked, and then throw it back in the oven for another 5 to 7 minutes until the cheese melts. And that, because the dough is already baked, it won't absorb and suck up that sauce.
All right, Amanda, get started now. I'll be by for dinner tomorrow evening. That sounds fantastic. By the way, we've got that recipe for Umberto's grandma-style pie at WPR.org/foodfriday. Peter Reinhart is with us. His new book is Perfect Pan Pizza. And, Peter, I want to check out another recipe you shared with us, Susan's Rosemary Garlic Potatoes Pizza.
Yeah, that's my wife. Susan is my wife. Oh. Those are her potatoes. I had to give her credit or I'd be in big trouble. And it's basically all the toppings in the book can actually be used on any style of the pizzas. But in some of the ones, like ones where we are partially baking the crust ahead of time, as we do for the Sicilians, it's great. You have other things you can put on it after the par bake. You can load the top of the pizza with all sorts of things. Because, again, pizza is just really the crust of the pizza, which is the key to any pizza, is really the vehicle for which you're transmitting or delivering flavor. And what goes on top can be really anything you want it to be. And so my wife has this signature recipe of oven-roasted potatoes with garlic and rosemary that we serve almost anytime we have company. We serve it as a side dish. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if we could take that side dish and put it on top of the pizza, along with a couple of other things that would complement it, and make it the star of the pizza instead of just the side dish. And sure enough, when you put it in for that rebake or that second baking cycle, the potatoes crisp up really nice. And then, we add some other things like arugula or baby kale or other things to green up the pizza, some fresh tomatoes, and then all the flavors just come together wonderfully. So it's just a variation on a theme. Let me just explain that my inspiration for a lot of the pizzas in the book, and there's at least 35 different styles of pizza here, or ideas for pizzas, is many of the ideas come from classic sandwiches, because I think a sandwich is like the kissing cousin of a pizza. Pizza is dough with something on it, and a sandwich is dough with something in it. And so anything that works in a sandwich can also work on a pizza and vice versa. So I started looking back to what are the sandwiches that really get me excited. And having grown up in Philadelphia, of course, I had to start with a Philly cheesesteak and a hoagie and a roast pork sandwich. Those are the three iconic Philadelphia sandwiches. And sure enough, they all work fabulously on a pizza. You just have to have a system for how to deliver them. And then it just took off from there. So you can make a banh mi pizza, for instance. Why does the toppings have to be Italian? Why can't it be Asian? Because it's, again, just dough with something on it. Who says it has to be only Italian or only Mediterranean? It works in any format. Every culture has their own version of dough with something on it or dough with something in it. A quesadilla is just a variation of a pizza. And as I said, even a grilled cheese sandwich, you could say, is a variation of a pizza. So all these things work because ultimately the reason they work is they always deliver flavor. And that's what people want more than anything else.
Time for another caller. Mike is with us in Rusk County. Mike, hi.
Hi. Have you guys familiar with Pequod's Pizza in Chicago?
Absolutely. Yeah, Pequod's is a famous pizzeria in Chicago.
Okay.
All right, so I just want to put my comment in is that, I think Pequod is probably the best pan pizza, bar none.
Gotcha, Mike. Not a great connection there, but he's, so Pequod's, you have heard of that, Peter, you said?
I have. I've been there. And there's a reason why their pizza is so great, and it has to do with the crispy edge of the crust. Wouldn't you say, Mike? Is he still on?
Oh.
You know, one of the things that they're famous for, because there's many styles of Chicago deep dish pizza, mm-hmm. and their version is kind of a cross between a Detroit style and a classic Chicago style. But the key, and I think their differentiator, is that the crust gets this wonderfully crispy edge. And I think, you know, when people go there, that's the first thing they want. When they're thinking of that pizza, they're already thinking about that crispy edge in the pizza, which is almost worth the whole price of admission right there.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike. For the pizza shy, Peter, the people who think this is too much of a challenge, too much work, leave us with a pep talk on maybe trying to make some pizza over the course of the next day or two.
Well, as I said, first of all, if you could just think of it in you know, pieces, like there's the dough and there's the topping, and you can work ahead and you can make that dough. You don't have to use it right away. One person said he likes to wait at least 2 days. One of our callers waits 48 hours. Once you make the dough and put it in the fridge, you can use it over the course of a week, and you don't have to use the whole dough up at once. You can make small pizzas and try them out. I always say that by the third go-round, you will have it dialed in. You'll figure it out. It's not, the learning curve is not that hard. And then the toppings, the instructions are very simple. And maybe start simple. Go with just sauce and cheese. I mean, really, if many of the people that I know who are pizza freaks, we'll call this community of pizza freaks, fall into two categories. They're either all about the topping or they're all about the crust. And I'm all about the crust first. And I think the toppings are a bonus, a wonderful bonus. But without a great crust, it doesn't matter how great the toppings are. It's just going to be a good pizza. But if you want a memorable pizza, you have to have a great, memorable crust. And it's just not that hard to get it. The instructions are simple. It's all about making the dough ahead of time and baking at the right temperature and letting that dough get golden brown. Everything else that you put on top will be a bonus. So keep it simple at first. And then as you get more confidence, you'll start to think of your own ideas or use some of the ideas in the book to inspire you to do variations on a theme. Jeffrey Steingarten, the great food writer, says that for him, pizza is 90% about the crust and 10% about the topping. I'll give him 10% and say maybe 80-20. But still, focus on the crust. Once you get that, you're home free.
Peter, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Peter Reinhardt. His new book is Perfect Pan Pizza. You can find some recipes from Peter at WPR.org/Food Friday. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new bipartisan bill in the state legislature would extend in-state tuition to any member of a federally recognized tribal nation across the country. We'll talk to one of the authors of that bill. First, a lot of Wisconsinites lack adequate access to comprehensive health insurance. That's according to the State Department of Health Services. Here's Health Services Secretary Andrea Palm speaking earlier this week.
Lack of health insurance affects far too many Wisconsin families. An estimated 402,000 Wisconsinites live without health insurance at some point in the past year.
The news comes as Governor Evers' administration moves to expand health insurance access in the state under the Affordable Care Act, even as Republican lawmakers challenge the Obama-era law. Our next guest joins us to talk about the steps being taken by the state and the impact that being uninsured can have on families. Donna Friedsam is a distinguished researcher and health policy programs director at the Institute for Research on Poverty at the UW-Madison. Donna, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Before we get into what the Evers administration is trying to do to close this gap, this figure of more than 400,000 Wisconsinites without health insurance for at least part of last year, who is going without health insurance? Is it focused on one particular demographic or kind of across the board?
No, we have different groups experience lack of insurance differently, but I want to clarify that figure of over 400 is the number of people that at any particular point in the last year might have had an experience, but overall at a given time, about 305 or 306,000 people in our state lack health insurance. And of that, about half of those people are below 200% of the federal poverty level, and about half of the people are above 200% of the federal poverty level.
And that mark, is that important because of access to support under the Affordable Care Act?
No, I was just starting somewhere.
Sure.
people can get support under the Affordable Care Act up to 4 times the federal poverty level, actually. So a family of four that makes almost $100,000 a year can still get subsidies under the Affordable Care Act to help them purchase health insurance through the marketplace.
So with this number of people, hundreds of thousands of people without health coverage, what is driving that? Is this people making the decision, even with support, I can't afford this? Do we know what's leading to people not having this coverage?
There's several factors that contribute to this. One of them is just not being familiar with what's available out there, because we know that about 20% of the people that are uninsured today would qualify for Medicaid and Badger Care, which is our state's safety net program and comes at no premium cost for people. So presumably many of those people, if they knew that they could get health insurance coverage without having to pay a premium, would be interested in having that coverage. But it's very difficult to reach everybody, and particularly when outreach and enrollment resources are limited. And I think that's what Secretary Palm decided she wanted to do with investing more resources this week, and that effort was to get that word out. But as well, there's been a lot of confusion about what's available in through the marketplace, through the ACA. Over the past several years, some people believe that the Affordable Care Act no longer exists. People don't understand what's available through it, or they think that it's very expensive, which it can be if you just look at the sticker price for many of the plans, and people don't understand that there's a lot of federal subsidy attached to those plans. So most people with average incomes can get substantial reductions in the premiums, but that's something many people don't understand, and they don't even go look. So it's important that people talk to advisors and enrollment assistors, agents and brokers to learn what's available. Certainly there's a few people out there, particularly young invincible types, who think, I don't need this and it's not of interest to me. But we really do believe that many people, if they understood what's available and affordable to them, would get attached to health insurance.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about the consequences and risks, I guess, of going uninsured?
Well, there's several levels of consequence of going uninsured. The most obvious one that people think of is kind of the catastrophic occurrence of if you get a terrible disease, diagnosis, or if you're in a car accident and then you can't get all the treatment that you need, or you may think you will because the hospital is going to have to do it for charity care, but you could face financial ruin. But on an everyday basis, people don't go and get the care that they need to prevent terrible things from happening to them down the line. And so they don't get the kind of preventive and primary care services that they need. Or people end up using the emergency department at hospitals for care that they could get more efficiently and more effectively in the outpatient setting and with a primary care provider. That's very costly when people use the emergency department for their everyday care, or when they wait to see a provider at the hospital instead of going to get their care from a regular source of care in the community. So these are the main problems that we have when people don't get insurance coverage and don't utilize the healthcare system in a way that is rational and effective for managing both their health and managing the costs of healthcare.
Talking to Donna Friedsam, health policy expert at UW-Madison, looking at uninsured people here in Wisconsin. At a press conference earlier this week, the head of the state's health department talked about hundreds of thousands of people without coverage at any given time. I want to give a listen to someone else at that press conference. They brought in one of the outreach ambassadors talking about navigating the insurance system.
I find health insurance confusing, as well as most Americans and most Wisconsinites. I don't think I'm alone in this issue.
And Donna, can you talk about what's happened in Wisconsin since the passage of the Affordable Care Act when it comes to outreach to help people overcome that confusion we just heard about?
So with the Affordable Care Act, there in states that participate in the federal marketplace instead of operating their own state-based marketplaces, the federal grants were given to organizations that were not part of state government to run outreach and enrollment programs with what's called navigators or community application counselors, CACs, and other kinds of enrollment assisters. And those federal awards were quite substantial in the early years. But in the last couple of years, they've been reduced quite substantially, and more than 80% of the funds have been removed at the federal level for supporting that outreach and enrollment. And that's, I think, why our Secretary Palm and the Department of Health Services at the state level decided that it was time to invest some state resources to try to reinfuse some energy into the effort of trying to connect people with coverage and help them understand what's out there.
Do you see this kind of outreach effort putting a dent in our current numbers of uninsured?
We see in other states that have invested substantially in their health insurance outreach and their marketing campaigns in particular, that there is a difference in the numbers of people connecting with and getting enrolled in coverage. So I do think that it could make a substantial difference. I think the messaging will be very important. We've had a challenge, I think, in our state in making sure people understand clearly what is the law and what is not the law. And I think it will be important for people to get a clear message about what is available, what the price of insurance will be for them personally, and what they can do to get themselves covered without being subject to a lot of misinformation or confusing messages. So that's going to be the most important thing.
One of the big controversies in Wisconsin is that we kind of pursued a unique path. We didn't take some of the federal money that could have been used to expand coverage. We did expand coverage in a way that other states didn't in some ways. Governor Evers had wanted to say, hold on, yeah, let's actually take that federal money. Lawmakers said no. Is that taking that money, would that help bring down the number of uninsured in Wisconsin?
Well, this is a very large debate, as you know, that's been going on for the past 6 years.
We've talked to you about it a lot, yeah.
Yes, I know. And, you know, the numbers show that if the state participated in the federal Medicaid expansion, we would add about 70,000 to 80,000 people to the Medicaid enrollment. But of those, about half of them would be coming from the federal marketplace, currently enrolled in the federal marketplace, and about half of them would be coming from the uninsured. So we would reduce the uninsured about 40 to 45,000 people, and that's a substantial number of people that would go from uninsured to having coverage, yes. And then the other part of the discussion is that it would be reducing the amount of money that our state GPR, our state tax dollars go toward supporting the Medicaid program because it would bring in more federal dollars. That's a different question than what you raised. But it's certainly a debate that remains because of the concerns that others have raised about bringing people from the marketplace into Medicaid.
If there's someone out there listening who doesn't currently have health coverage, would like to figure out what they're eligible for, if anything, they don't know how to get started, is there a common starting point?
Absolutely. I strongly encourage people to, they have several ways of going, but the easiest thing, if anyone around the state can call 211, information line, and ask to get connected with an enrollment assister in their area. Again, they can call 211. They can go online if they want to, go directly to healthcare.gov and try to work their way themselves. They can also go online and look at Covering WI, Covering Wisconsin, so coveringwi.org, and they can look there to find enrollment assistance or call or a phone number to call directly. And there are many people that will be available to help them walk through their options and understand the whole insurance environment available to them.
Donna, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you.
That's Donna Friedsam, researcher and health policy programs director at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's Population Health Institute. She joined us today to talk about the state of health insurance coverage in Wisconsin. You can read more about the state's announcement at WPR.org. Coming up, we'll talk to the author of a new bill in the state legislature that aims to boost enrollment of Native American students in the UW system. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Sheboygan County's airport is getting an international customs building ahead of next year's Ryder Cup golf tournament. Officials hope it'll continue well after that. We'll find out more during our state news roundup. Now, the number of Native Americans enrolled in universities has been low for decades. According to the U.S. Department of Education, Native Americans and Alaska Natives made up just 1% of the total students enrolled in college in 2006. That's despite those numbers more than doubling since the 1970s. A new bill in Wisconsin's state legislature is looking to change that by giving in-state tuition access to any member of the nearly 600 federally recognized tribes across the country. Nick Milroy is a Democratic member of the Wisconsin Assembly. He represents the 73rd Assembly District, which includes Superior, Trigo, and Spooner. He's one of the authors of the legislation. Representative Milroy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to how the legislation worked, let's get into the why a little bit. What led you to tackle this issue?
Well, I actually got the idea from an article that I read that was put out by the University of Illinois in Chicago, where they were planning on offering in-state tuition to any member of a federally recognized tribe. So I did some digging, and I noticed that the UW system has had good recruitment of people in color in every category except for American Indians. And over the last 10 years, we've seen quite the drop in number of American Indians that are enrolled in the UW system, and I thought this would be a great opportunity to provide an opportunity for people that might not otherwise have it.
And talk us through what exactly your legislation would do.
Well, the legislation would allow any member of a federally recognized tribe within the United States to attend any UW system campus and pay in-state tuition versus paying the out-of-state tuition. And that can be a significant amount of money for somebody coming to Wisconsin. For example, at UW-Madison, in-state tuition is about $11,000 a year, whereas the out-of-state tuition is $38,000 a year. That can be quite a barrier for people to come to Wisconsin.
Have you heard reaction from Native American communities, maybe here in the state or beyond, about this legislation?
I've reached out to some of my friends that are American Indians, and they were supportive of the bill. I think they would like to see more than just federally recognized tribes have this opportunity, but it's kind of hard to draft legislation that could encompass all of those different scenarios.
And I think it was in your press release about this, you talked about the idea that, okay, a federally recognized tribe that's in Wisconsin's borders now, that's one thing, but because many Native Americans were moved, in effect, by the federal government, that there might be a Wisconsin connection to many other tribal groups around the country.
Yeah, there is, and I think, you know, a bill like this is just a small step towards reconciliation where we live up to our history, where generations of tribal members were systematically removed from their ancestral lands. You know, those were done through acts of Congress. They were done through treaties. Many kids were forced to leave their reservations and their families. They were sent to boarding schools, sent to foster homes, and people were displaced all over the United States. So, you know, a lot of people have common ancestors that might have originally called Wisconsin home.
Talking to Nick Milroy from Wisconsin State Assembly. He's a Democrat who represents Superior, Trigo, and Spooner. Talking about legislation that he authored that would give in-state tuition access to members of federally recognized tribes around the United States. You mentioned University of Illinois, Chicago, as kind of your model and inspiration. Do you know if they've, I know this is pretty new there too, but do you know if they've started to see results there?
I don't know.
Okay. What kind of reaction have you gotten from your fellow lawmakers about the legislation?
Well, I wasn't really sure how people would take it. I was surprised with the number of co-sponsors we got. We have 27 co-sponsors on the bill, which is a lot for any piece of legislation. And we also have a strong bipartisan contingent. Nearly 20% of the co-sponsors are from the Republican Party.
And do you have a timeline on when this bill would start rolling through committees?
Well, the bill was just introduced and assigned an assembly bill number by the Speaker's office. It has been referred to the Committee on Colleges and Universities, and I will be contacting the chair to ask for a public hearing on the bill.
And have you heard from the governor yet on this? I know that's a long way off. It still would have to go through both chambers, but have you heard any support from the governor's office yet?
I haven't, but I suspect that if this went through the legislature without much controversy, I'm sure he would be supportive of it.
I want to switch gears a little bit, and now we'll keep watching that legislation. You're in the Superior area, northern Wisconsin. You are in one of the many areas of the state that's seen high rains and big flooding over the last few years. Can you give us an update on what kind of things you're seeing up in the Superior region, Representative Milroy?
Well, yeah, we have seen a lot of very heavy rainfalls over the last decade. It's torn our infrastructure apart. We've had to apply for federal FEMA funding to repair a lot of road infrastructure. And the most recent rainstorm washed out a few roads. But unfortunately, when it doesn't do enough damage, you don't qualify for federal disaster assistance. So the current roads that are being washed out are going to be the tab's going to have to be picked up by local taxpayers, which is unfortunate.
And I've heard one difficulty with FEMA is that often even when they do fund it, they fund a replacement of what was there already. And there's a concern that, well, wait, the stuff that was there already wasn't up to the challenge of the rains we're getting. Is that something you've been hearing about?
Yeah, it's a very complicated process to go through the FEMA funding. We definitely need our federal legislators to work on trying to streamline that process and also recognize that a lot of infrastructure that was built back in the day might not be up to the type of events that we're seeing nowadays with these what were once considered 100 or 500 year floods seem to be happening multiple times a decade.
And you mentioned that the locals are often having to pick up the tab to repair the damage. Is this something that the state is also helping out with, or is there anything in the works that might be able to help recover where FEMA isn't able to do that?
There are state emergency funds available, but they obviously don't cover 100% of the cost of these projects. And the more and more certain communities see this, it's usually in the same place. It's just an inequity in state funding and the ability for taxpayers to have similar type infrastructure as other parts of the state.
All right, we'll leave it there. Representative Milroy, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'm talking to Representative Nick Milroy. He's a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 73rd Assembly District. That includes the areas around Superior, Trigo, and Spooner. He's with us today to talk about new bipartisan legislation he's introducing that would give in-state tuition to members of any of the nearly 600 federally recognized tribes across the country. We also checked in with him on damage related to flooding over the last couple of years in his part of the state. And I want to throw a question out to you. A lot of Wisconsin, in one way or another, has been hit by torrential rains over the last 2-3 years. Flooding risks in south central Wisconsin, only the most recent, some in northeastern Wisconsin as well. Question for you, have you been affected? Has your community been affected by flooding? Even if it hasn't been in the headlines the last few weeks, whatever stage you're in recovery, what is going on where you are? Are the roads fixed now? Are you doing things in your community to try to withstand future intense, severe rains? If you're in local government, especially love to hear from you. What kind of funding challenges are you dealing with? Have you had similar concerns with what FEMA can and can't do for your community? Here's how you can reach out to us and share your story. We might talk about it in a future episode of Central Time. You can always email ideas@WPR.org. You can send us a message via the Ideas Network Facebook page, and you can tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. What has flooding meant for you and your community in Wisconsin? Do you feel like you're ready for the next round of flooding? Has flooding led, as in Gays Mills and some other communities, to moving businesses, government buildings, houses, things like that? Again, reach out to us via email, ideas@WPR.org. Send us a message on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us and maybe share a picture if you have one at Central Time WPR. Question one, do you like fast food? And question B, do you like tabletop role-playing games, things like Dungeons and Dragons? If your answer to both of those questions is yes, I know there's probably a few of you out there, this could be your lucky week. The fast food chain Wendy's just released their own rules for a role-playing game called Feast of Legends: Rise from the Deep Freeze. On one hand, yes, this is clearly an advertising stunt. On the other, some game experts have reviewed this and said, yeah, this is actually a D&D-style game that people could actually play. It's only available in an online PDF format. It clocks in at 97 pages. That's short for a role-playing game, but it's pretty elaborate for a corporate tie-in. Instead of playing fighters and wizards, players can create characters who belong to the Order of the Beef, the Order of the Sides, or the Order of the Chicken. The game includes rules, a how-to section on creating characters, and an adventure in which our heroes face off against the villainous Beef Bandit. Well, maybe it's time for a Central Time home version. I don't know if it'd be a role-playing game, but a board game, like reflecting the behind-the-scenes realities. Like donuts, you know, would be involved somewhere. That'd be kind of like the main thing. Because, yeah, you'd just be like radio people, like wandering around looking for snack tables put out to celebrate whatever. That reflects the realities of radio life pretty well. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.